Welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today's episode features Graham Farrar, president of California-based Glasshouse Group. This episode was recorded over the phone on March 5th, 2021.
Graham Farrar, president of Glasshouse Group, CEO of Glasshouse Farms, one of the best vertically integrated brands here in California, right now currently ranked second highest selling cannabis flower in the state. I got to ask, man, you know, being somebody that comes from the traditional market, you know, you're part of the founding team over at Sonos, and you went over to a couple of other companies before finally starting a nutrients business, which is kind of ancillary to the industry. You know, growing cannabis personally, I know you got into that, but I got to ask, what was kind of the spark, you know, the moment that made you say, I'm going to be a part of the cannabis industry?
That's a good question. I think the answer is, I think the world is a better place with cannabis in it. I really always have. I enjoy it personally. I think that the war on drugs, quote unquote, which is really a war on people, is a travesty. I think the natural state of nature is to not be illegal, and a plant is, you know, almost the very definition of nature. So I think I always thought that we could make the world a better place with cannabis, and that plus the opportunity to build a business and form a whole new industry at the same time was more than I could pass up, and I'm sure glad I didn't.
was it like a specific meeting or like a specific moment where you're like, you know what, no more traditional market jobs, you know, I'm going right for cannabis? Like, you know, I'm trying to look for that exact spark, like, because there's a lot of people that kind of, you know, weary on the edge of maybe getting in or maybe getting out, especially as new markets emerge. I'm really curious as to what that one impetus was.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not a timid person. So if you look at the things that I've done, right, you go to software.com as one of the first companies. We basically were a digital post office. We made email servers back when the world figured out that even if you didn't work at a university or in the government, that you were going to get on the internet and that was going to come with an email address. We made the software that kept your email until you pulled it down to your computer, which was, you know, very new. Broad-based thing was called software.com. We went public in 99, right in the dot-com boom. And then after that, I helped start a company called Sonos, which is like an iPod for your house, basically. And again, this is Spotify or Apple Music, right? This is like Napster had just come out. iTunes or the iPod had just come out. So this was very early days. People didn't even know what digital music was. Then I started a company that made apps for kids, right when the iPhone came out, and we converted movies into narrated books. And then cannabis, right? And I think it seems like they're disparate, but the common thread is that I've got a lot of experience doing things that people have no experience doing, right? So it's always kind of stepping in to this this frontier space. You know, it's one foot off the ledge because the rule book hasn't been written yet. And if you think of it in that context, cannabis, it's almost, you know, it's the very definition of today in cannabis. So, you know, I think that the moment that you're looking for, that spark, was we started a nutrients company that was designed around kind of more large scale or professional scale cannabis. It was not, you know, it was away from the quarts and gallons and things like that, and in the totes and 270 gallon and 55 gallon drugs. And the moment when I realized that I was going to really do this was that we were selling to customers who were on the vanguard of cannabis cultivation, and I realized they had no idea what they were doing. So that plus my experience having things people have no experience doing, my tech focus, you know, I'm kind of a tech guy by training and a cannabis lover by passion, putting those things together was more than I could resist. Dove in head first, both feet, and 6 years later, here we are.
Well, since you joined the industry, it's definitely evolved. Obviously, coming here in California from the Proposition 215 days now to the Proposition 64 days, you know, the entire industry has evolved, not just here in California, but especially looking at, you know, several states around it or just emerging markets. When you look back to when you first jumped into the industry and then you look at where the California cannabis industry is today, in your opinion, what's been kind of the most significant evolution that the industry has taken?
So, I mean, in California, Prop 64 is certainly, you know, kind of a recent inflection point. California has always been a leader in cannabis, 26 years, I think it is now, since we legalized it medically here. Prop 64 was passed in 2016, went into effect 2017. So, you know, we're kind of coming into the fourth year of that. The market's changed a lot, right? I mean, it went from something, and there's pros and cons to it, right? It went from something that was very gray in the Prop 215 collective model. You know, it's like, you know, from an enforcement point of view, the sheriff's guy wasn't really any sure, more sure than you were about if you were following all the rules, because no one knew what all the rules are. It's the polar opposite that now. The pendulum is, I would say, swung too far, right? There's too many regulations. There's too much oversight. There's too much taxes. But it has advanced from the point of view that at least there's clarity on the right ways and wrong ways to do it. Now, I hope over time we get to put that pendulum back where it should be, and more in the middle, less tax, less regulations. You know, we don't need tamper evident, child resistant packaging on an eighth of flour any more than we need it on a fifth of vodka, right? It's like, if you think about in a dispensary, you've got security guards, bulletproof glass, tamper evident seals, child resistant packaging. And if a kid ate that, like, at the worst, they'd get an upset stomach. I mean, if you ate flour, you wouldn't even get high, right? So maybe they'd get a bellyache. Contrast that to a liquor store where you got one guy way in the back, the alcohol's almost flowing in the street, a fifth of vodka, has no tamper evidence sale, has no child resistant cap. If the kid drinks that, they die, right? And so yet we treat this cannabis, this plant, like it's going to jump out and kidnap kids, and alcohol, like, you know, it should be the babysitter. So I hope we can, you know, bring those things a little bit, reconcile them a little bit more rationally. We got a lot of work to do. We've done a lot, but we've got a lot more left to go to get it right.
Well, and I think that also, you know, looking at the industry, obviously being, you know, touching so many different areas of the industry that you guys do, it has to be banking, right? So, you know, the effects of 280E on operators in the industry, you know, being able to do localized banks or bring on, you know, investment capital from traditional banking systems. Are you hopeful in the next maybe 3 to 5 years that kind of gets worked out with maybe, you know, new legislation coming into fruition? Like, what are your hopes for regulations in the industry coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, so we're one of the lucky ones in terms that we have banking for everything. It was a, you know, it's a good sign of how weird the cannabis industry is and how formative it is, right? Like, and no other business would getting a bank account be part of your business plan, you know, like that would just be a check the box thing as a morning. In cannabis, that was a 4-month process after 4 years of not having one, and we literally had a celebratory dinner when we got a bank account, right? So to give you some context on the industry. So we're happy to have that now. It certainly makes life easier. It makes, you know, it's hard to imagine it at the scale that we're at without that. But banked and fully banked are two different things, right? Like, having a bank account is not banking, right? Banking is working lines of credit and being able to get a loan to buy a property and, you know, being able to process credit cards and things like that, right? So yes, we have a bank account, but we're still wildly underbanked as an industry. That inhibits a lot of the growth. I mean, you know, again, we're kind of lucky in the way things have worked out. You buy a farm in tomatoes, you borrow 97% of the money, and then you pay, you know, a 3% interest rate because it's an ag loan and it's all subsidized by the government. In cannabis, not only can you not get an ag loan, but you can't get a loan, right? So, you know, you want to buy a $10 million farm, well, you need to write a $10 million check, right? And there's no financing, there's no leverage, and it's just a cash out of the pocket, right? And so that really drags the industry down. So I'm hopeful. I mean, I think it may happen this year. There's a decent chance the MORE Act or something similar passes, and all of a sudden you can list on UX exchanges, banks should open up, credit lines should open up, cost of capital should come down. So, you know, again, it's nothing special. It would just be a reversion to the way it is in every other industry. But for cannabis, that's going to feel like a, you know, a party because it's never been there.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of people, you know, definitely parting with different green rushes across the country. Here in California, you know, kind of when we shifted from 215 to 64, obviously getting a license was very hard. There's a lot of, you know, MSOs now that are operating in the state, a lot of big players, especially coming into Southern California or Northern California grow communities. You know, being somebody that's been in the Central California region, you know, kind of making it your own, you probably have seen a lot of operators kind of doing it wrong. You know, I know that in the beginning you kind of talked about, you know, being a nutrients guy and seeing how those people were doing it wrong during the 215 days. Being somebody that is so focused on being eco-friendly with your operations at Glasshouse Farms, I'm curious, you know, because there is a big problem with a lot of companies not doing harm reduction or types of sustainable practices in their growing operations, mm-hmm. especially a lot of the indoor operators. Can you kind of talk about what your farming practices are and kind of what the most important thing in your view that some of the other operators might want to look into to benefit their own operations?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's good to start from a philosophical point of view on this, right? So our philosophical belief is that everything we do in this business starts with the plant, right? If it wasn't for the cannabis plant, none of this would be here. The cannabis plant comes from the earth. It comes from, you know, Mother Nature, natural environment, our ecosystem environment, whatever you want to call it, right? So to run a business that is built on something and then not protect that source of, you know, wellspring of where it comes from seems, I don't know if the word's hypocritical or ignorant or what, but it doesn't seem right. So we've kind of got a philosophical approach that we need to protect the source of everything that we're doing. And we like to operate, we call it the triple bottom line. So it's good for the customer, good for the planet, good for our business and our employees, right? And so I think one of the cool things about sustainability and eco-friendliness when it comes to agriculture is that those things are actually compatible, right? I mean, there's not necessarily a tension between those things, right? Like good agriculture is efficient agriculture. Efficient agriculture is a low footprint, right? Like bad agriculture is wasting water, wasting nutrients, wasting energy. It's you're throwing things away, right? So it's either bad for your customer because your prices are too high, or it's bad for your business because you don't make enough money and you know go out of business, and it's bad for the environment. And agriculture done right is precision agriculture, right, where you give a plant exactly what it needs to get the result you want, no more and no less. And that's good for the planet because you're maximizing what you're getting with taking as little as possible. It's good for the customer because you can deliver high quality at low cost. And it's good for our business because it means that we are sustainable and can treat our employees well and can explore new technologies and make money. You know, something like the idea that you can be successful capitalistically and environmentally and, you know, social justice and community-wise, like that's the thing about cannabis that's really exciting. Usually you have to pick one or two of those. In cannabis, we get a chance to do them all at the same time.
And you know, you guys are definitely doing them all right. I mean, if you look at, you know, where you guys went December of 2019, you guys were ranked 67th in the state as far as your brand house flower went. Now you guys are ranked number two as of last December. So clearly you guys got the product down. So I'm curious from your perspective, what you kind of think is the most important attribute, you know, to a sale when it comes to launching a cannabis product?
So our approach, you know, I can't say we know everything, but we've certainly learned lots of things not to do, which is sometimes just as valuable, is quality, consistency, and efficiency, right? So first you got to do it great. Then you got to do it great every time, and then you got to do it great every time efficiently. And in our case, efficiency doesn't mean, you know, cheap or not caring. It means delivering a high quality product at a reasonable price, right? So again, efficiency. If you throw things away, then you can't do that because you're wasting, right? And so for us, efficiency means give it just what it needs to get the optimal result, no more, no less. And that result of that for the consumer is awesome cannabis at a fantastic price because we're able to do things and run a good business while achieving the rest of those things. So, you know, we took the approach of the first 5 years, we were just growing, you know, kind of a white label wholesale, right? I mean, we were growing cannabis and we were learning how to tune things in and we were learning how to do that quality, consistency, and efficiency over and over every time, better and better. There's no such thing as perfect in agriculture. So all you are is always on the quest to be better tomorrow than we were today. Once we felt like we had that to a point where we could say, yes, this is good. And yes, we can make sure it's good tomorrow and the day after that. And yes, we can do it at a price that is, you know, reasonable and fair and accessible and, you know, is better than what somebody else is doing. That's when we flip the switch to branded, you know, CPG, Glasshouse labeled product. And I think the market is, you know, it recognized that and rewarded it. And it said, yeah, this is good. And yeah, he brought it three times and it was good all three times. And oh my gosh, like this is as good as I was paying $40 for, but I'm only paying $30 for it now. And like, that's what consumers want, right? I mean, they want, my goal is to be kind of the Casamigos of cannabis, right? That's what I want to see us be. Casamigos is, if you're a tequila person, right? It's like, it's always kind of the right choice. You know, it's not 1942. It's not, you're crazy if you put this in a margarita. It's not, you bring this out on graduation night. It's not, you sip this and don't talk about other things while you drink it, which is one of my favorite tequilas. There's nothing wrong with that. But Casamigos is like, you know, it's great on a Tuesday. It's great in a shot. It's great in a margarita. It's great on a Friday night. It's great at a party, right? It's not Jose Cuervo, which, you know, fake and sugary and, you know, I wouldn't drink it. It's not 1942. It's right in the middle where it's kind of always the right answer. That's what I want our cannabis to be, you know, mass luxury, attainable luxury, always, you know, it's never a bad choice, right? And that's what we're trying to accomplish, and I think doing a decent job so far.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at what's hardest for a brand trying to bring a flower to, you know, to fruition, to me, it's got to be, you know, making sure that you're getting your genetics dialed in, making sure that you're bringing the right strains to market. I'm curious that when you're going through your research and development process, what does it look like when you're going through the different phenotypes, and how do you finally determine which strains to finally bring to market?
That's a good question. So I think, you know, genetics are interesting in cannabis, and I don't know what the right word is. They're democratic a little bit, right? Or like in many apples, for example, like if you want to develop a new apple strain, I think it's like a 30-year process, right? You got to take apples and cross them and plant the seeds. And then the tree's got to grow for a decade before it makes a fruit and stuff like that. Cannabis is kind of anybody can do it. And so the result is that everybody has, right? You take two plants and you shake them together, male and a female, and you're going to get seeds, and they're going to have some of the shared traits of each of them. And then, you know, you're going to get 1,000 seeds. Every seed is going to grow a slightly different plant because cannabis is, they call it homozygous or true breeding, doesn't exist yet. So everyone's kind of like people. It's, you know, your brothers and your sisters aren't identical twins. And then you pick from those your favorites, and you can make them and, you know, make moms and clones and stuff like that. So on the one hand, there's this complete, like, utter, you know, bazaar of choices. And on the other hand, you can actually make your own stuff too, which is pretty cool. So there's a lot to hunt for. We kind of approach it from, you know, the categories, right? So we want to have some things in CBD category for people who are looking for something calmer and, you know, more relaxing, more glass of Chardonnay versus shot of tequila. We want some things in the category that are really good for solventless extraction, which is sometimes different. You know, it's a more terpene profile flavor, things like that, the structure of the trichomes for extraction efficiency. You want some things that are sativas and indicas and hybrids and, you know, fruit smells and jack smells and things like that. So you're really kind of trying to build your SKU list or your kind of suite of products, and then find the absolute best representation of each of those, and then cross that with how does it grow, right? And what season does it grow in, so that from an operational point of view, you can deliver the best expression of whatever that target is all the time. Hope that answered that question.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. And I mean, it, like I said, it's one of the hardest things to really dial in for a brand, to make sure that you're bringing to what the consumer is actually going to want. You know, and it's definitely not easy in the best of times. Obviously, the last year, 2 year and a quarter have kind of been a little bit on the harder times, you know, with COVID-19 kind of hitting the world and having a massive impact, you know, on businesses across the board, you know, not just the cannabis industry. Being as integrated as you guys are, and, you know, being deemed essential here in the state of California during the pandemic, how have you guys kind of modified your SOPs in order to kind of navigate the current pandemic?
Yeah, so cannabis really accelerated through the pandemic. Not necessarily something I would have predicted out of the gate, but I think there was a lot of new users that came into the market. You know, if your kids came home last March for spring break and never left, that's a pretty good tool to sell some tinctures to help you, you know, calm down and sleep through the night. I think we saw some people who really, you know, are medical users stock up on cannabis just like they would if their pharmacy, they were afraid their pharmacy was going to close and get their, you know, their medication. And then I think we saw people with more time on their hands. Cannabis, you know, is maybe a somewhat better fit for hanging out in your house with Netflix than it is for going out to a bar. And so I think we saw consumption patterns shift that way. Here in California, as you mentioned, we are deemed essential, which means that we never had to close either at the farms or the stores. So, you know, that it was certainly helpful to the business. We hired, I think, 175 people throughout the pandemic, didn't lay anybody off. So, you know, for us, it was a big growth year. That said, it was kind of, you know, and like it was for everybody, it was kind of like trying to ride your bike with the brakes stuck halfway on. So we did a bunch, you know, we did night shifts so that we had less people at the farm. A farm's pretty good, you know, 500,000 square feet, not a hard place to socially distance. So that part's easy. The trimming and the processing, we put up our, you know, plexiglass and staggered shifts and staggered lunch cycles so that the lunch tables only had half the people at them and everybody wears a mask and, you know, all the stuff that, you know, we certainly weren't unique in the trials and tribulations that presented, but we did what we could and we kept on going and, you know, nothing but good news, right? Didn't have to lay anybody off. Everyone's paying their rent and buying their groceries and filling their car up with gas and, you know, helping keep the train at least chugging along a little bit so that we can restart it now that things are starting to get better.
Well, and you guys currently have, I believe, 4 retail licenses. You guys got Bud and Bloom, the pottery, and then 2 different locations for the pharmacy, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Got it right.
When you guys are kind of looking at the aggregate data across the past year, obviously, you know, people kind of being locked in their homes, are you seeing a surge in the delivery aspect of your retail operations, or are you seeing that kind of stay static or taper down as things start to open up and people start to go back out?
So I think a little bit of both, right? So cannabis hit some kind of all-time highs throughout the pandemic, and you know, I think statistically it's impossible to hit a all-time high every day. So things have, you know, the kind of the rate of the, you know, the steepness of the curve has calmed down a little bit, but it certainly hasn't receded back to where it was before. So I'd say it's kind of held the ground that it came up to. And I mean, hard for me to see what puts it going the other direction, right? Like we're the furthest we've ever been in social sentiment. We've got more dispensaries than we ever have had. We'll have more dispensaries tomorrow than we have today. Federal legalization's closer than it ever has been. More states, you know, acceptance in society, more uses, more products. It's like, you know, everything is really, really pushing that direction. It's you know, from an investment point of view, it's super exciting. You see the multiples in cannabis are similar to alcohol and tobacco, yet alcohol and tobacco's growth rates are like flat to negative, and cannabis growth rates are like 100% year over year growth, and yet you're paying the same multiple for them. So when the stigma breaks down and the barriers to investing break down, I think you're going to see valuations for cannabis companies go nuts.
Well, and you're looking at different markets across the United States currently open up. I mean, outside of the international markets opening up, but just here in the United States, I mean, we just had, you know, Wyoming look towards legalization. We just had New Jersey sign legalization papers for adult use consumption.
And
a lot of brands right now are moving into those new markets. You guys are killing it right now here in California. Is there a possibility of a future expansion into a new state? Or is California your guys' main focus, flagship? You guys are just going to stay here and crush it here?
So, I mean, I think California is far and away the best market out there, right? I mean, California is almost twice as big as the second biggest. It's almost as big as the next 3 markets combined, right? It's about 27% of the national market. So, you know, if you think in the MSO term, right, like 27% of the country is 13 states. So California is like a 13 state MSO in the country of California, right? And so if you think about it from that point of view, if there's one place to be, it's here. If you think about California from a cultural point of view, it's a cultural builder for across the board, but it's really a cultural builder for cannabis, right? So a whole lot more people saying, I want California cannabis than I want Pennsylvania or, you know, Idaho cannabis, not to pick on those states, but it's like, you know, people want Napa wine They don't necessarily want Florida wine. And so I think you can, we have a really large free focus group. It's called the Illicit Market, and it tells you what people want before they can have it. And if you go there, pick a bodega in New York, like it's all going to be California brands because that's what people want. So I think our approach is succeed in California, the biggest, the most competitive, the most discerning cannabis market in the world, build and win here, and know that the rest of the country and the west of the world is going to want what was built and won in California. Then when the walls come down, if that's a licensing deal or if it's shipping from California, whatever the format is, we'll be able to take advantage of that and succeed across the planet, hopefully one day.
Awesome. Well, and I don't have too much time left with you. I have to ask, somebody that's been a consumer for so long as you have, being an underground grower back when you were in the tech industry, what is your favorite method of consumption currently, and what is your favorite strain if you had to pick one?
So I'm kind of like basic as it gets when it comes to consumption. I like rolling joints. I always loved the tech, so I always buy all the Puffco Peaks and vaporizers and all the toys because I'm a gadget geek. But at the end of the day, I like smoking a joint. The flower to me tastes the best. I don't have the highest tolerance in the world, so being able to smoke a joint keeps me having conversation afterwards still. I do love to get, they call them donut, when you take a joint and you put a little snake of a live rosin in the middle. That's the weekend indulgence dessert kind of approach. But for me, I'm pretty simple. So I like it all, but smoking joints my favorite.
Any particular strain of flower that's your favorite?
I used to be a real sativa guy, and I think it was because I'm kind of energetic and don't like being dull. But one of the things I've realized is that I appreciate different things at different times, and I'm personally a fan of like the kind of the funky, fruity terps, so papayas and stuff like that just have that kind of real thick, fruity flavor I'm a fan of. I still like my sativas. We have a great sour diesel, so I like that. We have a super silver haze that I've been growing for 25 years that is consistently high testing sativa. I like that. But I don't know. If I was, my ideal weed would actually be delicious tasting and like 12%, because then I could smoke the whole joint, enjoy it all the way through, still be able to talk afterwards, right? It's like, if my favorite beer was as strong as Everclear, I actually wouldn't be stoked. I'd be a little bummed, right? I'd want to water it down into mixed drinks. So sometimes I like taking our Jellyfish CBD and blending it with one of our real tasty indicas just to mellow it out a little bit so that I can smoke more of it and get to the same spot just because I enjoy the smoking.
We would like to thank Graham for his time and being on today's episode. You can find out more about Glasshouse Group by visiting them online at www.glasshousegroup.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you here on the next episode of Conversations in Cannabis.